Hi, it's Clint and Lyndon.
Welcome to Shove It Up Your Arwen.
As always, our opinions are our own and should be taken with a pinch of salt.
At the sound of the Arwen cow, enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Shove It Up Your Arwen. I am one of your hosts, Clinty. You can find me on Instagram at, what is it? Clinty Sky Guy. Okay, there we go. Your turn.
Okay. And I'm Lyndon and I'm the other host. And you can find me at Pilgrim in the Mist.
Pilgrim in the Mist!
That's right, you whore!
Right, fab. So, we've got a fun episode where... Get off my fluffy hair. We've got a fun episode where we're inviting a guest, and you'll get to meet them in a bit. But before then...
Magical moment.
Magical moment! Do you have one?
No.
No?
Yes, no. Kind of.
Yes. What? You do this every time.
I know. Keep you on your toes.
What?
Do you have one? More to the point.
Well, do I have one? Do I?
Okay, well, while you percolate on that, I'll talk about mine.
Percolating.
So,
percolating.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah.
Don't hit me.
Sorry.
Did you
see the restraint?
It's such an aggressive tit. I was like, fucking, I saw my life flashed before my eyes.
So I do kind of have one and I don't. So at the moment, I'm preparing, obviously, to be confirmed. So we're praying the rosary regularly, which is lovely. That's going well.
Yep.
What was the laugh?
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. My brain made it weird. It's fine.
Okay.
Just carry on.
So we're praying the rosary regularly, which is great. And then this week coming, so tomorrow I've got penitential service, so my first confession. So my first sacrament of reconciliation. And then, then what? Then Thursday I get my feet washed by the bishop. He's going to suck my toes.
Ah, gross.
And you're like, yeah.
Don't be gross.
Suck on it, David. Suck on it.
Carry on.
Yep. So that's something else to confess over.
You want a bishop to suck your toes?
Yeah.
That's a bit weird.
No, I need to clean my trotters up, to be fair, before he does that. They are like hooves.
Yep.
So that happens on Thursday. And then, again, I've got to go to the church on Friday for another service. And then Saturday I get confirmed. And I finally get to have the Eucharist. In a proper manner.
Catholic biscuits.
Nice. I've had Catholic biscuits before. Because when I first attended the church, Wayne was like, you're baptised, aren't you? I was like, yeah. He's like, go, just go get one. I was like, I don't think I'm allowed. He's like, yeah, of course you are. Just go.
And then
go.
You found out you're allowed. Not
so
allowed.
I went up there and I held out my hands and poor John looked at me like I just spat in his face. He really did. He looked so put out. But because I was there and my hands were like that, he gave me one, so I've already partaken.
You're holy.
I'm holier than thou.
Oh, duh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you're definitely holier than that.
Because you're a healthier apostate!
I'm not an apostate.
No, you're not.
No, I'm actually not an apostate.
Although you would be if this was Dragon Age.
This is not Dragon... This is real.
I don't know.
It could be. This is real. Stop it. This is real.
So, but then I'll actually really, really, really be allowed to have these.
Really be a Catholic.
You'll
be a real Catholic. A real good Christian woman.
Yeah. With my like magical charms in my pockets. And
just amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah.
A Catholic who does magic.
And my magical jewellery.
like that's not a normal thing.
Of course not.
Because... They all do it.
They all do it. So that's kind of mine. I've got things in the motion. And that's it.
Fabulous.
So a few little rituals, a few little rites, a little bit of foot washing, and then I'll be able to imbibe the flesh and blood of my God.
Delicious.
Cannibalism!
Yes, motherfucker!
Marvellous.
What about yours?
I don't really have one. I've not really done a lot, if I'm actually completely honest with you. It has been, actually. There's not been any need for it.
Disappoint me.
I haven't missed my daily devotions. Apart from I haven't done them today. Today is the first day I've missed them.
Oh.
But I can do them at any point today, so that's all right. I'll do it before I go to bed. So technically still haven't missed a daily devotion yet.
Okay.
Feeling loads better. Got my voice back properly, which is nice.
It is good. Your gubbins are healing well.
My gubbins are healing well. Get off my gubbins. And yeah, it's all really good. It's all really, really positive. There's loads of positive stuff at work. I've not done anything active, which is a bit strange because I don't think I ever go a day without doing something. Something? I mean something.
Something.
Something. Pronunciation. Enunciate. Yeah, I haven't really done anything directed.
Okay.
I'm trying to think, because I have to think really carefully, because I curse on the daily. Which you already know.
It's all right, Jesus forgives you.
Oh, fuck off. Fuck off.
But he does!
Oh, my God. I turned around...
That's his shtick.
Do you know, I turned around to James the other day.
Yes.
And said to him that he should do... I can't remember what it was I told him to do. It might have been suck a dick. Because it's just rude, and this sounds like something I would say.
Yes, everyone should.
He responded with, I can't do that, that's a sin. And I went, well, get on with it then. And he went, why? I went, because Jesus died for them, and if you don't sin, he died for fuck all. And he looked thoroughly, thoroughly horrified that I just said that if you don't sin, Jesus died for nothing.
Oh, I'm going to go out and shoot someone in the face.
I was just like, I think he was just like, how did you come to that realisation? I'm just thinking, these things happen. Logical. It's a logical thing. No, I don't think... I did have a success with my dedicant programme until it was robbed from me this morning.
Bitch. Bitch.
They've probably got every reason to be, like, judging me on my writing, but...
I do.
It's just annoying.
I judge you.
Judge me? You judge me daily on my messages.
I do.
And it's...
Everything.
Everything.
The face.
Fucking everything.
The appearance.
The appearance.
Personality.
Personality.
Lack thereof.
Oh. I knew that was coming before it even hit. Yeah. Don't pretend to love me, you scum. I'm sorry, people. I don't really have a magical moment.
You're a boring cunt.
No.
Would you like to do some magic?
Yeah.
Do you want me to get you my palm? I'll get you my palm and you can burn it and do something with that. How's that?
Why would I want to do stuff with your Christian nonsense?
I don't know. Uh-huh. Sacrilege.
Sacrilege? What? What? It's a bit of leaf.
But it's a holy leaf.
It's a holy leaf.
A holy,
holy leaf. Yeah, cool. Okay, so I reckon it's about time for us to move on to our topic. So
okay.
We will go and get our guest and be right back.
Okay, so we're going to introduce our guest today. This is Chris. Chris does a podcast himself. Would you be able to introduce yourself to everybody, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a long story. Any kind of introduction for me. Where do I start? I am a practicing cultist nowadays. I run a community, or a new community that actually just launched last month, called Golden Shadow Academy for esoteric and occult education. But my background is actually predominantly in archaeology. So my degree and all my studies and the thing leading up in academia was originally in archaeology. And I specialized in really the archaeology of magic, especially in late antiquity. And eventually I kind of branched out a little bit more and went into sort of late antique mystical philosophies, mainly Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, and to a lesser extent, Gnosticism. But I'm also an active practitioner. A lot of my practice, because of my background, is drawn from historical texts or sort of historically, or just like the archaeological record. I mean, I'm predominantly a reconstructionist. But my main two sort of big ones are, I guess, the PGM, so the Greek magical papyri, and tracing that kind of methodology into sort of medieval and Renaissance. I guess what we would call the Solomonic method, although I disagree with the label quite a lot. And everything sort of around that and into modern occultism. I'm not the biggest fan of modern occultism, I'll be honest. I keep more of the traditional stuff. But that's more or less where I'm at. So I'm trying to think of like two initial words. will define me. I mean, I'm definitely, my practice is definitely more ceremonial, but ceremonial or planetary magician or planetary talisman maker, I guess, with the focus on sort of PGM, Greco-Egyptian magic is the best way I can introduce myself.
That's fab. That's fab. So, so yeah, occultist, really. Yeah. Like, it's kind of like the definition of an occultist is somebody that does the things that you've kind of just described. And describing yourself as a magician is interesting as well, because a lot of people would conflate that with the illusionist magician, and it's not the same thing.
Yeah, I suppose it's part of a wider thing. I suppose we can get into at some point here. Of one of the biggest issues that I've seen in modern occultism is there's really a lack of clarity or lack of definition around what words mean, and a lot of words are used synonymously, but they really mean different sort of distinct practices, like magician or witch are used interchangeably, or mystic and magician are used interchangeably, and magic, mysticism, and witchcraft are three different things almost entirely. They refer to like three completely distinct practices. They may share some general worldviews and cosmologies, but they are, you know, methodologically speaking and experientially speaking, in terms of what it's like to be a practical explorer in that kind of realm of things, they give you different experiences. So we really need to be using different terminologies, but people don't know them. That's not the problem.
People often don't. So so we're going to talk about our topic today, which is going to be sacred texts or texts within our various practices. And we're very, very different. So you've described yourself as an occultist and a magician. I would describe myself as a druid and possibly a sorcerer. And Lyndon is Catholic and a charmer. So I think if I pass over to you, Lyndon, because I want to pick on you because you haven't said very much yet. What would you define as a sacred text or a text that you use?
A text that I would use. Well, I use the Psalms quite a lot, and the Bible. Those are the two kind of big ones that I use quite a lot. But I don't really go down the whole kind of ceremonial path.
No,
I've got books on it, and I kind of look at it, and then, like, I've got one of the books downstairs. I've got Black Abbot, White Magic.
You told me about that one before.
lots of emotion, and I read it, and after about 10 minutes, I'm like, I've got no idea what any of this means. It's like too complicated.
That's a common feeling. Yeah.
Oh god, my brain just isn't big enough for it. So I just stick with my little kind of low magic. Little charms, give me a bucket and a spoon, I'll make something happen. But like, any more than that,
it just reminds me of Spoon Jar Jar Spoon from like Tommy. Oh,
you're looking at me like I know you.
Yeah, never mind then. Tommy, someone on the podcast listening will go, yeah, Tommy Cooper. That's it.
Is it Cooper?
Again, I'm
the
looking
comedian,
at you as if you know.
Wear the little,
he wears a little thing and he goes, Spoon Jar Jar Spoon. And it's on a bit of string. Somebody behind him pulls the string and it pulls the jar out of the spoon. No.
Okay.
Spoon out the jar.
I'm glad you're having
this. It's like a weird fever dream memory of everything you're saying, but I can't actually place it.
No. Sorry, Chris. I'm sorry. Bear in mind, this is what it's like.
It'll only go downhill from here.
It's only going to get worse. So you've got the Bible.
I've cleared my schedule. I've got my tea, so I'm good to go.
I'm quite lucky as a druid, because as for sacred texts, there are
lie.
None. No, it's
a
not.
Lie.
No, it's
You've
not.
You've got lots of shit.
No, there are.
You have. You've
what?
Got... Okay. Well, not off the top of my head. No. but you've got. I suppose it's written through like a kind of Christian monk lens, but you have all the old stories, depending on.
Well, yeah. If you want to look at.
So you've got all the songs and stories, and you've got the
Mabinogi, you've got the history of Ireland.
So are these not considered sacred texts to you, considering it holds the story and
really.
The history and what a lot of the practice is built on?
Nah, not really.
No?
Nah,
okay,
not really.
Fuck it. Throw it in the bin.
Fuck it. Throw it in the bin. Nah, I suppose you could.
I would argue it is, because without all that stuff, you wouldn't have the understanding of like Ceridwen and Taliesin. And then you wouldn't understand what Arwen was. And you wouldn't understand all these other concepts that you druids hold sacred.
Yeah, all right then. Fine, I'll shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Fuck you. Okay, yeah, I suppose then the Mabinogi and shit like that would be a sacred text to a druid. The same way the Bible is full of stories. Okay, fine. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, if we could, yeah, all right, okay. So I'm being thick yet again and thinking sacred text is like some convoluted bullshit, but actually it's just a book of stories, isn't it? So, yeah, fine. There's the Mabinogi, there's the Tales of Ireland, there's the Tales of King Arthur, for another example. There's, I don't know, Beedle the Bard. No, that's Harry Potter.
That's Harry Potter.
That's not real. But you've mentioned the Greek papyri, but are there any others that you would say are important to your own personal practice, Chris?
Yeah, well, I because I'm actively either, well, the majority of my practice is, yes, PGM, Kuru Greek papyri, but also sort of medieval and Renaissance. The majority of my work as a ceremonial magician is predominantly textual. So I use a lot of text because the tradition that I work in is a learned tradition, ultimately, right? It's like it's something that is actively written down by usually members of the clergy. And this is like another thing people seem to miss a lot of the time. A lot of the Renaissance sort of what we call the Goetic tradition, or just kind of the general sort of ceremonial tradition, the main writers, compilers, and users were Catholic clergy. They were active members of the clergy, because we have this kind of perception in, you know, when we look at, you know, or we look at the theme of like summoning demons or summoning spirits, whatever it is, you know, you picture some like necromancer in like the bowels or whatever of some catacomb somewhere. It's like, no, like if you want to put yourself in the mind of a person who is composing and using these texts, you know, think the University of Paris, right? And the University of Paris is a cathedral school for Notre Dame. If you want to put yourself in the mindset of somebody who is actively working in these traditions, you're probably going to be a low-level clergy member. You probably have a moderately... an abbot, also a low-level clergy member of some kind. You probably have a general knowledge of Latin, probably not very good because the Grimoire Latin is not great. But you are predominantly in a Catholic context, right? And that's the thing. Yeah. And this is something that people miss, I think, a lot of the time when we're dealing with especially the ceremonial tradition, especially the Ars Goetia. And fair warning, I have some major hot takes about the Ars Goetia that have almost gotten me cancelled twice because I think
go on. Okay. So your hottest, give us your hottest take on the Ars Goetia, because like,
spill the tea.
Because that's just grand. Yeah. That's grand. Anybody can have an opinion about anything. If you like something or dislike something, you're quite within your right to do both.
So here's my thing. Right, here's my thing with it. I'm hesitant, like a part of me, the emotionally reactive part of me wants to go, the Ars Goetia is just shit, honestly.
Right.
But as a scholar, I have to sort of sit here and be like, no, I have to structure my argument a little bit more and explain why. Here's the deal with it. And I think my aversion to it, it can really be distilled more down to, I think it just gets more credit than it's worth, or it gets more credit than it's due. People in the ceremonial tradition, or even like modern occultists on the whole, I think it like the Ars Goetia is one of those grimoires that everybody has either heard of or everyone's kind of glanced at some point. Like they flick through all the sigils, whatever, the and all that kind of thing. And people think that's it. They have this kind of perception that the Goetia is the pinnacle of the ceremonial tradition, that every magician was working out the Goetia and summoning those 72 spirits. It's like, historically, and if you look at it in the context as a text and what texts it evolved from, the Goetia is effectively, for lack of a better description, it's the scraps and all the kind of weird bullshit that nobody wanted to put in the other grimoires, so that somebody basically came along and stitched together and just sort of threw into one book without any real care or any understanding of what was really going on. Mm-hmm. And like the ironic thing with it that I always, and this is the part that's got me cancelled, because I phrased it the wrong way once, where I said the Ars Goetia is a joke, and then I didn't explain myself properly. What I mean by it is I'm technically not wrong, because the Ars Goetia actually begins as it began its journey as a text as pure satire. So the main sort of the preeminent source for the 72 spirits in the Goetia is Johann Weyer's Sura Monarchia Daemonum, which was another text that was written obviously by Weyer, who was the student of Agrippa, so Cornelius Agrippa. And Agrippa is, if you are familiar with any sort of modern occultism, if you're using any form of correspondence, whether it's, you know, candle colors, numerology, anything like that, certain crystals corresponding to certain planets, whatever, the vast majority of that goes back to Agrippa. And his student, Johann Weyer, wrote this text, the Sura Monarchia, originally as an appendix to another one of his texts. I can't remember the name of it now, my head. But it was in, basically, it was his defense of the witches in witch trials. He was one of those really interesting people who were one of the first people to suggest that actually a lot of the people or a lot of the women who were being tried and, you know, murdered in the witch trials were maybe not experiencing magical phenomena, but some of them may have been mentally ill and they were struggling with mental illness. And he was one of the first people to suggest it. And it's kind of interesting because he writes this whole treatise defending these women and basically saying, you know, but they're suffering from mental illness, we shouldn't be prosecuting them in the kind of way, they need to be helped, that kind of thing. And to illustrate his point, that like the core element of his text there is that magic is not real, right? And he's trying to justify this idea that everyone who thinks that they are witches are actually suffering from mental illness. And right. To illustrate his point, he writes the Sura Monarchia as an appendix to that text. And he kind of includes like 68, 69 of the demons that appear in the Gars of Oasia later on. And he phrases it in this kind of way where he's like, oh, well, yeah, look how stupid all these people are. They believe in all these demons. Like, look at how ridiculous this list of demons is. It's so stupid. Ha 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 ha. And then somebody basically took that list, combined it with some of the other lists that have been circulating around sort of the continent for a while, and then took it seriously. And made it into a grimoire of itself. And then everybody since kind of Mathers and Crowley and the Golden Dawn, that kind of thing, they take the Goetia as like complete gospel, because a lot of times people's first exposure to the occult. And it's like, when you unpack the history of it, it's not that the spirits themselves are not real. I think they are very real entities in of themselves, but the way that they're presented contextually, if you understand the text, then they're actually presented as a satire originally. So it is kind of, it's intended to be a joke in a weird kind of way, especially it's a joke against magic, right? But and it's just it's one of those weird funny things to me where everybody is nowadays so obsessed with the Goetia, and they're like, oh, you know, the Goetia is the core of the ceremonial method, you know, blah, 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 we have to summon all these spirits. And I hate to say it, the vast majority of it is just vanity. It's people sort of sitting there going, oh, well, I'm gonna summon Belial, Baal, Paimon, or whatever, because it's a big name and they want to sound fancy. And it's like the Goetia is like the end stage of a thousand year long tradition, and it's not even a good culmination of things. It's like the scraps of the tradition that didn't make it into the other grimoires, you know. So it's an interesting thing, but
it's a similar thing to isn't it the book The Black Pullet? That's a work of fiction as well, isn't it? But people put a lot of stock in that book as well, don't they?
Yeah, we can pretty easily, if you think of all the sort of narratives around a lot of the grimoires, the Black Pullet is an example. Like the main story with the Black Pullet is it was written by it's like a French soldier who was in Napoleon's army when he was invading Egypt, and then he got attacked by sort of Arabs or Turks or something like that. I can't remember when it was. And he sort of falls off the beaten track and gets sort of finds an old man who takes him into this hidden chamber in the pyramid, and then teaches him this kind of talismanic magic that then he codifies in the Black Pullet. The story itself is almost completely fictional. Like there is no historical basis at all to the story, but the Black Pullet does contain some sort of core talismanic images that are taken from cunning craft, you know, or that are taken from other sort of traditions. So, and it's one of those interesting weird debates that you always end up having, especially if you sort of loop in things like servitors and thought forms and chaos magic, that kind of idea, where it's like, even though the system isn't technically real, quote unquote, like it doesn't have a historical precedent, enough people have used it that they are getting some form of results from it. So there is something happening there, whether it's that they are working off of older traditions that kind of accidentally seeped their way in, or if they are themselves constructing those experiences, we don't know.
It makes me think of Gerald Gardner's book, wrote, which was a work of fiction. And he wrote a work of fiction before the Witchcraft Act was repealed, didn't he?
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called. High Magic's Aid? Is that what he called it?
Yeah.
And it was marketed as a work of fiction. However, he wrote it with magical stuff written inside it. It's a terrible work of fiction. It's a terrible book. However, if you write it and you're in the know, then you can isolate the bits that are actually... And it makes me wonder how many times that's been done where actual elements have been put into a book.
Yeah.
And like the actual elements exist. You just said, like, you get results from them. You get the things you need. It's just the story and the window dressing around the actual method is just changed or moved around. The Asgotir, an example of actual demons' names being put into a book and then everything being kind of like decorated around it so that it's just putting flowery language around real things to make it look legit.
I think it's to a certain extent very human because, you know, and this is something that you learn, especially if you're looking at sacred text and mythological texts across the planet. Humans love to tell a good fucking story, right? We love it. We go on, we natter all the time. It's brilliant. We love telling stories. It's a very human thing. So we want to create these narratives around things. But a lot of the time there are, I guess, what we can say are core mysteries that are communicated through sacred texts. And, you know, this kind of loops back to the discussion you guys were having a little bit earlier about whether things like the Mabinogi and all sort of mythological narrative texts are sacred texts in that kind of way, or if they're more kind of religious or, I don't know, mythological text. And it's like, while you may not draw direct practice from mythological texts, the mythological texts, like the Mabinogion, for example, they contain core mysteries and core truths that influence the worldview of your practice. And without them, you know, you're not, you wouldn't be able to situate yourself in a practical tradition. So in that way, they are sacred. In that kind of way, and again, it comes down to
right. Okay, Lyndon. Okay, I've been told off. All right, I get it. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Fuck off. Fuck you. Damn it. Oh well. All right. Fine. It's weird. All right.
Well, again, it depends how we define sacred text. Because, like, the easiest sort of the most simplistic definition would be it's any kind of text that is either, you know, channeled or handed down by some kind of god or spirit or anything like that, anything that is used in a mystical context, right? And in that kind of way, we could argue it's anything that isn't necessarily composed via, I guess what we could say is like dialectical reasoning. So anything that's you're not using...
Wait, bloody hell is dialectical reasoning?
So you're rationally...
Say again, sorry, Chris.
So your rational mind, effectively.
Oh,
right?
Okay,
if you think of when you're going through experience, and this is one of the things that sometimes distinguishes mysticism as well, where if you're looking at what defines a mystic, mystics usually are, in one way or another, searching for an altered state of consciousness in some kind of capacity where you are entering, you know, the mystagogue state, effectively, where you are open to something sort of coming through. And there is this interesting kind of debate that I've seen go around a couple of times, and that mysticism, whatever, is all irrational. And it's not magic and mysticism, things like that. They're not irrational, but they are non-rational, right? But just because they're non-rational doesn't mean they're completely irrational. You're not going to be using reasoning or sort of, you know, logic and reason saying, okay, I did this, this, and this, and this thing happened, and then you can repeat my results, or you can repeat my process, and then the same thing will happen to you. No, it doesn't work like that, because you're dealing with a personal, a lot of the time, feeling sensory-based experience. But a mystic cannot say whatever they want, right? They still have to be situated within their context, right? They still have to be situated within a wider sort of mythological narrative or a wider tradition. And the problem you have is that the second that you take them out of that tradition, they no longer make sense, or the magic in the worldview no longer makes sense. And that's kind of the problem that we've had with sort of the ceremonial tradition, and especially the Ars Goetia, in because, I hate to say it, but because a lot of people have religious trauma, right? And they often come, a lot of times they will come into occultism or spirituality or anything like that, and you know, whether it's spiritual groups or anything, they will come out of it from a place of reactivity. From, they may have left Christianity or had a bad exposure to Christianity or Catholicism or anything like that, and they sort of dive deep into occultism and they think, oh, you know, they develop this very kind of anti-Christian, anti-Catholic bias of things. They think, oh, the Catholics are all against magic, that kind of thing. It's like, as you guys know, it's just not true. Like, yeah. Whether it's like cunning, you know, charmers or anything like that, a lot of them had dual faith. They practiced all the elder faith and Catholicism. And almost all the compilers and composers of grimoires in the Middle Ages were Catholics, right? It's like, and that's kind of the ordeal. It's like, when you look at, if you were sort of put up like a census record of medieval and Renaissance Europe, and you're like, okay, how do you identify yourself? You were either a Catholic or you were a Jew. There is no other option in Renaissance or sort of medieval and Renaissance Europe. Like, what we take today, atheism, spiritual, whatever, all these different things, they just didn't really exist back then. I mean, you can maybe make the argument that someone like Spinoza, with his whole pantheism thing, is like the first like departure from that kind of tradition. But everybody in medieval and Renaissance Europe, at least, you were either a Christian, a Catholic specifically, or you were a Jew. And there's no other option, really. So like every magical tradition in that capacity, especially the ceremonial tradition, is composed in that context. So if you then take it, if you take those books out of a Catholic context, the worldview doesn't make sense.
And God, yeah.
I think you lose something in terms of the practicality if you don't put it into that worldview. You know?
Yeah.
I love it. I can literally see your brain exploding right now.
Leave me alone. Like, so, oh, fuck. So,
you can do it.
Yeah.
Connect to the mothership.
Connect to the mothership. I was looking at, what was I looking at the other day? The Book of Oberon. And I like it. I like it. And I've spoken to you about the... Look, this is really difficult, Lyndon. Stop it. Me and you, Chris, spoke about the Gnome Grimoire. And I recently got the third part. And I was looking at the Book of Oberon and I was looking at the Gnome Grimoire, Gnome manuscripts. Mm. And I was like, this is all very, like, after reading it for a little while, I was like, the reason that I don't gel with a lot of it is very much based on the context of its time and place of being written. So, you know, the Gnome manuscripts were written during a time where, like you just explained, everybody would have been Christian. So everything you're doing is like, when you're working with spirits, even in the Gnome manuscript, and although it's not so heavy, it still is, you know, there are still Hebraic symbols. There's still a lot of, it mirrors a lot of the stuff I've seen in, for example, the Asgotia, or Goetia, just, and the stuff in the Book of Oberon is very do it because God said so. And trying to deconstruct that slightly to use the sorceress method in there in another context is really difficult. And that's exactly why, is because of the time and place in which these things were written. And you find it a lot, like you mentioned the Mabinogion and the Mabinogion, yes. And of course, that was written through a Christian lens because the people who documented it were monks, for example. I think that's why I said right at the beginning that there aren't any sacred texts, because for Druids, I'm not a reconstructionist, but that was stupid of me to say, but Druids didn't have sacred texts. They did everything orally. But then, of course, it doesn't mean that a Druid nowadays doesn't have sacred texts.
Well, no, because you're neo-Druids, aren't you?
Yes, so of course I am. Yes,
you're not building on the bones of an old religion. You're building a new religion based on the information you have at hand.
Yes, exactly. So I was being thick.
No, you weren't. You weren't being thick. You're precious.
I was. Precious and lovely. Anyway, we're all precious and lovely. But it's...
Oh, my brain's so muddled.
it's good to have these conversations. I don't have these conversations often enough. But it's good to unpack that. That I think it's so. When I studied occultism fleetingly because it got on my nerves, and ceremonial magic specifically. It was all like Crowley and Mathers, like you literally mentioned in the Golden Dawn, and it fucking does my nut. I got very bored of it after a while. Not that it doesn't have some good things in it. And you know, once you can do the LBRP, you can do loads of things.
This is another interesting point, right? So, yeah, people. I don't know. What am I trying to say here? I think they really kind of over dramatize or they over glorify Mathers and the Golden Dawn and Crowley.
Yes.
Mainly because I think it's purely because it was the most popular or like the most mainstream initiatory order. So it's our primary archetype for what magical lodge work looks like, largely. Yeah. Like if you look at even Wicca and Neo-Druidry, anything like that, if you're going into, you know, actual lodge work or anything like that, it's all largely based off of Mathers and Crowley. For the most part, I'm based off the Golden Dawn system, which is inherently also based off of Freemasonry, which is its own interesting little thing, right? But like Crowley is his own interesting figure, and yeah, we could have another entire podcast talking about Crowley.
Oh God,
I have mixed feelings about Crowley. I think like there are, don't wrong, some of his stuff is good, like some of his magical stuff is interesting. He was a real rat of a man, if I'm being honest. God. So you really need to kind of, you know, separate out Crowley the magician and Crowley the man if you want to work with any of his stuff. Like his stuff is good, but yeah, like he was. I'm the biggest fan of the psychological model of magic as such, and he was very, very kind of hardcore into the psychology model because that's kind of just that was the science of the day that was coming out, right? It was psychology at Crowley and Mathers's time was what quantum physics is today, right? And it's the same way, you know, you look into all the modern spiritual cycles and people saying, oh, quantum entanglement proves astral projection, all this kind of other like quantum shit, right? They were doing the same thing. Crowley and everyone was doing the same thing to psychology because it was the new science at the time. And he makes the weird statement that, yeah, what is it? All the 72 of the goetic spirits are actually, you know, they correspond to 72 parts of your brain. And I'm like, I can maybe get behind him saying like your mind or your psyche, you know, that's a bit different. But to say they correspond to your physical brain is just like, nah, okay. I don't know what the fuck he was smoking, but you know.
Again, I think we get mixed up. The mysticism is quite old. These things don't change very much.
No.
You know, the general core of what they are doesn't change a lot. You know, we've had it all a long time. We just use different words to describe it.
Yeah.
And then when we get these new sciences, I mean, science by its definition is just the observation of phenomena, literally.
Right. Well, science is a method. Ultimately,
yes.
And this is the other thing that people I always love telling people this, because do you know, at least in terms of like if we look at medieval Europe, right, do you know what the origin really of the medieval science philosophy is? Do you know where it comes from?
Not really. I know that we have the definition of science today is effectively just different schools of observation, and it's about the method of observing such and such. So
yeah,
a quantum physicist
observes.
Do you know
where that comes from? Physics.
No.
The methodology of observance, right? It largely enters medieval Europe via the Picatrix, right? So the astrological, the Arabic astrological, like the most famous Arabic astrological grimoire, the Hebrew translator from the Arabic, whoever it was makes a change in the translation of the Picatrix the change that he makes in it effectively laid the philosophy for the medieval European scientific method. Cool. And so like the entire, I'm hesitant to say the entirety of, but a large amount of the philosophy behind observing nature as a sort of a natural philosopher, and then like, you know, constructing hypotheses, testing them, basing observation, all that kind of thing, that can be more or less dated to the Picatrix, which is it's the most influential magical grimoire on medieval Europe, right? It's like the origins of science in medieval Europe are tied to magic, and you can't separate the two,
which is what I love. which is what I love, because
like, you can even see the same thing, because the word, like the word experiment, for example, is used in grimoires long, long before it was appropriated by mainstream science, right? Experiment is literally like, it means operation, or like experimenta in Latin. It's used in magical grimoires. It's used even in the Book of Oberon, right? If you look through it, it's like, oh, this is an experiment for invisibility. It's an experiment for acquiring wealth, money, whatever it is, love, something like that. But the word is used in magical contexts long before it's used in scientific, well, quote unquote scientific mainstream ones, right? And there really isn't a distinction, because even what we would the early Renaissance church, the Renaissance philosophers, Giovanni Pico, Marsilio Ficino, or even Agrippa to a certain extent, what they dubbed as natural, quote unquote, magic at their time was what we would call the natural sciences today, right? Botany, natural physics, geology, anything like that. All of those began as under the banner of natural magic, right? And in opposition to kind of demonic magic, by at least what the church describes as demonic magic. But there's like, there is this kind of, we really can't separate magic and science, because magic is a science, right? It's scientific in its approach and its methodology. It's saying, okay, like, let's say you want to, I don't know, you have an intention or a hypothesis, you say, or you have a theory, you say, okay, I want to I want to attract more love into my life, for example. And you can go through a grimoire. You can either go, there are different ways you can do that, right? You go through a grimoire, you find a spirit, whatever it is. Or if we're going down more like the Picatrix route and the Planetary route, you build up associations, you check the astrological timings, all that kind of thing. And you look through it and you're like, okay, I know I'm going to need two or three people to do this ritual with me. I'm working with a Venusian spirit because it's love. And to work with a Venusian spirit, I need these correspondences or this kind of incense, because this incense corresponds to Venus, whatever it is. And I need these tools, whatever it is. I need to face this direction because this is the direction associated with Venus or anything like that. And you add all those things together into this beautiful little cauldron or melting pot, and you try it out, right? And you try out those associations. And when you do it, I'm hesitant to say right, because I don't think there is necessarily a right way to practice magic, but right in this context, I guess, you know, you put the associations together at the correct timing and all that kind of thing. And I would say a good 60, 70, 80% of the time, it works. You have some kind of effect, right? And it's like, when you think about it and you really drill down to it, that's about as accurate as any scientific model. Like, if you ask a chemist or a physicist, like, has there ever been a time where you've put stuff together in an experiment and you got a different result than what was expected? It's like, yeah, probably like 20, 30% of the time, things don't go, like reactions or whatever, don't go the way we think they will. And it's like, magic has more or less the same kind of success rate. But in my experience, when magic is successful, like, it worked pretty fast for me. And I would say, like, within sort of 10, 12 days, usually for me, I've got results if I've done it sort of astrologically and everything is correct for me. I usually get results about 10 to 12 days. So it does work pretty fast. You know, I'm not really an avid believer in this kind of modernist spiritual self-help approach where it's like, oh, well, if I do, you know, a little ritual for a job and then 6, 7 months later, I suddenly get one, you know, like, I don't really think that qualifies. You know, and it's like that's more kind of just good psychology than.
Are there people out there that are like that?
Yeah, yeah. I think I've met people out there that are like that.
Yeah.
Oh, it was because I did a spell 2 years ago. No.
Yeah. And it's very easy to make things fit, right? But it's like, no. It's like, this is the other thing. It's like, it doesn't
mention
it doesn't detract from, what should we say, like, it doesn't detract from the efficacy of all the other psychological things. Like, psychology can be really fucking powerful. Your mind is a powerful thing. Like, sometimes you don't even need magic to create a result. You can do the result with your mind, with good psychology, right? It's like, there's no shame in admitting that. But my kind of whole shtick with the whole thing is like, just don't call it magic, because it's not magic.
No.
I love
sorry.
You, Chris.
I'm so sorry. My brain went, does that mean if I think you're a cunt, then you're a cunt?
Yeah.
this is the nature of identity now.
Yeah.
So you're a cunt because I think you are, Linda.
Basically.
Lovely. That's brand.
I think, was it Rene Descartes' whole, I think, therefore I am? So that's it. Yeah. If you think you're a cunt, are you a cunt?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. So kind of off the back of that, I just want to ask, what's your favourite? So because we had this conversation a little while ago, like my favourite magical practice is probably divination because I do it all the time. Well, I say favourite. No, it is. It's just the one I do the most of. So if I could ask you the same question, what's your favourite or most frequent magical action? Is that a thing?
Yeah.
That's a thing.
Yeah. Like acting ritually or acting magically.
Yeah, acting magical. Not thinking about people as cunts, but actually doing things to make them into said thing.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd ever do a ritual to make someone into a cunt. Like that's not in my wheelhouse. But
I've said that far too many times now. I feel bad.
You filled your quota.
Yeah. I filled my quota of that for the day.
I think I've said it more times in the past 5 minutes than I have like in the past year.
Welcome to Shove It Up Your Arwen.
Yeah, there you go. Let me think. So my favorite kind of ritual, this is gonna surprise a lot of people actually. I'm honestly gonna say Mass and the Eucharist.
What? Mass? Yeah. Oh shut up. No. Yeah. Stop it.
I'm literally going to say it. Yes. And here's why, right? Let me tell you why.
Transubstantiation and all that jazz.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking. So I can tell you the story, right? So in my new community that we were building, me and a couple of friends came together, and we are all very kind of hardcore into theology and historical stuff, and we're all kind of all Neoplatonists and Hermeticists on my end, and we kind of sat there and we went, okay, Neoplatonism had a huge, huge impact on the early Catholic Church. And a lot of the early Catholic theology is not modern Catholic theology. Like a lot of the modern Catholic theology, sort of post Vatican II, or post Second Vatican Council, it really departed from its historical roots. But if you go back to sort of the theology of the early church, it's much, much closer to Plato and Neoplatonism. And they knew it because it makes sense because a lot of the early church fathers were either in the same environment of Neoplatonists or even were Neoplatonists in a manner of speaking, right? And what we ended up doing in my community is we looked at the general sort of layout of the Mass, or we look at like a typical Catholic Eucharist. And we said, okay, let's start out, first of all, by removing everything post Vatican II and having like an early Catholic theology Mass rather. And we did that for a little while and that was really great and it was working. I was like, this is an interesting kind of ritual. And then the inner hermeticist inside of me came out and I was like, you know what, I really want to kind of shift this up. Like I don't have any problem with Catholicism, but it's like I really want to try and do a Eucharist but a hermetic Eucharist. Like I want to do a hermetic Mass, right? So I want to like remove all the Catholic sermons, all the kind of Catholic theology, and replace it with theology that we get from the Corpus Hermeticum or other sort of hermetic texts. And I want to see what that brings, what kind of experience that brings. Me and a friend sat down and we sort of fleshed out basically like a ritual outline for, it's about an hour long Mass with a Eucharist at the end. But we take from sort of what we can say is the ritualistic elements of Hermetica and Neoplatonism as well. So we sort of open, and this is something we do every week. So we do this every Friday in our community. We run a Hermetic Mass every Friday. And it is like a full-on lodge ritual, effectively. So we will open, we will, you know, purify the room in kind of historically, at least as possible, historically accurate ways. And then we will follow this outline of the Mass, and it begins with invoking planetary intelligences, angels, all that kind of thing, invoking the daily Shem HaMafarash angel, which is really important in Solomonic work or ceremonial work, and then sort of going through the various planets and all that kind of thing. But all the liturgies and the sermons and the theology is all from the Hermetica, and it's all from Neoplatonic sources and that kind of thing as well. And it was one of those things where I grew up Catholic originally. Like before I got in, before I got like hardcore into occultism and that kind of thing, I was raised in Catholic school. In fact, I went to a cathedral school effectively when I was going through like my sixth form and stuff. So I was familiar enough with sort of the Catholic worldview. Then it worked for me. That I was like, okay, yeah, let's try and you know, because I hadn't really ever been, even though I had grown up Catholic, I'd never actually been to a proper mass. Like, I'd never actually been to a proper cathedral mass service in that kind of sense, or at least I'd never partaken in mass. So when we started doing it, for the first like 2 weeks that we were doing it, the first two masses that we did, I was like, this is like, it just feels like a lot of reading. Like, I don't really feel like there's any ritual element to this. It's just kind of a bit boring. But then by about the third week in, something just shifted in me. And it's like, when there is, like, when we're doing invocations to the divine mind, or we do sections where we invoke sort of the holy guardian angel, you know, via sort of the Abramelin operation, or Abramelin, and all that kind of thing. And there was just a very palpable presence that comes with doing that ritual whether it's every week, or if it's just that I'm doing it in the same space, where I have my temple room and like I do it in the same space, and it you know, raises the vibration of the room, whatever you want to call it, or it's just the theology that gets you thinking or whatever it is. But it is probably the most powerful ritual I do on like a consistent basis. And it's become, you know, such an important aspect of my life now that like I struggle to go a week without doing it. I'm like, I really need the guy. It's very kind of cleansing and purifying in that kind of way. And it does make me feel, as an occultist, it feels weird to say, but it does make me feel closer to God, you know, so cool. In whatever capacity that is. But it's interesting because like it blurs the lines a little bit between religion and magic. You know, and I think it's one of those really difficult things where I don't, like, people have tried to separate the two for centuries at this point. And I really don't think you can, because religious practice and magical practice are ultimately, they are situated within each other. They are contextual for each other. So it's, you know, you can't make that distinction.
I've got to admit, actually, I don't like admitting this, that during my own studies, when we were doing Thelema, me and a group were doing Thelema, we were practicing quite heavily, and it was a case of memorize it and perform it. And that was the job. It was memorize it, perform it. And we would meet up once a month, and we used to do the Star Ruby followed by the Mass of the Phoenix. Yeah. And we were working on God forms.
Yeah,
that's what we were working on. And the Mass of the Phoenix is quite interesting because it gives you the opportunity to engage with a divinity of your choosing, almost. You know, there's you know, as a practitioner, you're able to just kind of like zone out a little bit and just think of your own divinity, and you're having Mass with them. And I do remember that being quite nice. Almost to the point that it's kind of made me realize that something I've been looking at recently is probably spurred on by a longing to do it again.
Yeah.
It's a bit odd. Because I've been looking at something called the Red Meal, which is just a transubstantiation in another context, really.
Yeah.
And sharing that meal with a divine being, and setting out the stuff, like you were mentioning earlier, Venusian stuff. Yeah. You're doing a love magic, you set out the copper, the roses, the things, you do it at a certain time of day on a certain day of the week, and that's a love spell, you know. And this effectively mass or red meal that I'm going to do is pretty much the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see how that goes. But
all agreed, mass is the best ritual.
Oh,
ever.
No, shut up. Because it's not my, you know, but maybe, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm not lying, there's something to be said for it. Like, I sit there in church, I hate doing it, but I'm not going to sit there and fanning the flames, yeah, calming my feet down because I've got no hot, stood in the church, whatever. But I've got to admit, like, there are moments where, and spiritual things and magic appears to me quite visually. So there are moments where the room will change colour, or there will be moments where I will see things enter the cathedral, or they will travel up the pews, or it will come in above the altar. and, you know, items will glow in a certain way, and I'll be nudging my other half going, what's it doing? And he's like, nothing, shut up. And I'm like, right, okay, you can't see that then. But, yeah. You know, it's at poignant moments. And then I quiz him afterwards going, well, what were they doing at that point? And he was like, because the host was in there. I was like, so Jesus was in the biscuit. The biscuit was in the
cracker, wine and crackers. It's the true that's it's the it. True meaning behind going to church. You get free wine and crackers.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. But it's just like, oh, Jesus is in the cracker. That's why I could see glowing around the monstrance, moonstrance, monstrosity, whatever. I want it back. I told them they've borrowed it for long enough. The same as my big copper bowl that they've got, and I told them I want that back. So it's, what's I getting at?
You love mass.
Well, no, I don't love mass. I can pick up on two things here, because you mentioned two things that are actually really interesting about, especially being visual. And it does make it interesting. I suppose if we were to try and loop this back to sacred texts again, or magical texts in general, one of the things.
I warn you, we go off track.
Yeah, yeah, you did warn me. I'll admit, yeah, and I love the good rambles. There you go. one of the things that's always struck me as really, really interesting, and this is another thing that I have continuously lamented on all my social media, and when other people ask me, and it's quite a triggering thing when I tell people, because no one likes to acknowledge it, but I think it's very true. The standard of, I guess what we could say, quote unquote, proof for spiritual experiences, mm-hmm. or, you know, spirits in general, the standard of proof for their influence or their sort of appearance during a ritual has dropped hugely. And what I mean by that is, if you look at either the medieval or the Renaissance, you know, grimoires and the sort of the ceremonial tradition grimoires, even on the other end of it, if you look into, you know, like cunning folk traditions and depictions, you know, like descriptions from the witch trials of witches encountering their familiars and all that kind of thing, they are talking about very vivid experiences that you would be forgiven for thinking that they are physical, right? When you look at a grimoire, even the Ars Goetia, right, it gives you descriptions of spirits. They are very clearly physical things that these people are seeing and describing, ultimately. And it's the same thing with the witches, right? Even in the witch trials and the cunning sort of charming for them, or the Salpa tradition, where the way they describe their familiars are as physical entities that come to them, and they physically see them in some kind of way. It's not a, you know, it's not a visualization in some kind of capacity, or it's not some, you know, it's one of those things where, I don't know, like, it's something I see in a lot of the kind of the modernist sort of neo-Goetia, neo-ceremonial magicians coming in, and they're like, they'll be doing a ritual, and they'll be like, I don't know, their incense smoke will waft a tiny bit, or a candle will flicker, and they'll be like, oh, that's it, the demon's here. You know, and it's like, yeah. Something happened, there'll be like the floorboard will creak or something like that, or like something really minor will happen, and they'll start like they'll take it as sort of gospel proof. They're like, that suddenly like everything's there, right? It's like, to me, that's a signal that standards for qualifying like if a spirit is there or not, or like a ritual is working, like the results of ritual, they have kind of dropped. And I understand why, because, you know, people don't necessarily, we don't, as a society now, because it's not an actively big practiced mainstream thing, we don't have the context, right? We don't know what's considered a quote unquote good or like, you know, deep spiritual experience there. And it's really, really interesting when you think about it, because there are, at least in the ceremonial tradition, there are two things that have consistently shown up for me, and then there's also I can talk a little bit separately about the PGM, because that's a bit of its own, the Greek papyrus, it's its own kind of weird beast, but for the ceremonial stuff, there are two main ways that I've seen, at least in my own practice and having spoken to other practitioners who I'm actively working with, and even in the instances where we've done this in person, like where two of us have come together in person to do a ritual, we've kind of experienced similar things. And it's the two ways for me that, that it tells you the spirit's there, or it tells you that the entity is kind of coming or is on its way, right? Number one is a light fluctuation in some kind of way. The lights of the general environment will shift in some way. It will either become darker, or it will become like the room will become brighter, or like it's not in the sense of there'll be like little flashing lights, whatever it is, like it's not like that. But there will be a noticeable brightening of the room. And I spoke to Stephen Skinner on a podcast a little while ago. He was on my podcast a little while ago. And he confirmed the same thing, that he's had the same thing. And he described it as like sparkling air, basically. So like, if you look at, I'm like doing it now, you can't see me because you're recording the audio, but I'm like under my window and it's very sunny right now, and there are dust particles in the air. Like if you look at a window and you see those kind of like dust flecks or specks, whatever, just floating in the light, right? And then they're kind of like shimmering little white dots, that kind of thing. Imagine that, but in like a dark candlelit room where like the room in general, like the light just increases in general, in some capacity, right? Like that's a surefire way for me to be like, okay, there's something here. That's a visual sense. The other is usually an auditory one. And it's the best way I can describe it is, and I've also experienced this during meditation as well. So I don't know if it's like a ceremonial spirit specific thing, but there will be some kind of like ringing sound when a spirit is in the room. And I don't, I miss it. And like, it happens for me, but I've spoken to other practitioners who have experienced something similar, where when you finish like the first or the second conjuration, whatever it is, then there will be this ringing sound that starts to develop. And the best way I can describe it for me is it sounds like, you know, like a Tibetan singing bowl. Or I guess kind of like, you know, like an altar bell that like people will ring at masses or whatever, like the church bells. It sounds kind of like a very soft version of that, but it's very distant. Like it's almost like you're listening to it, you can hear it, but it's like it's in the other room. It's like if you just took a singing bowl, went and sat in the other room, and then someone just started playing it, and you can like kind of half hear a ringing sound like in the back of your mind. But there's a weird caveat with it where the more you focus on it, the more it disappears. Yeah, right? The more you try to intellectualize it, like the more you're like, oh, am I hearing something? Let's try and focus on like where that's coming from. The more it disappears. And the more like you can't like focus on it too much. So you need to stay in the moment. So like you can take those experiences, be like, okay, yes, there's something here, and then carry on. Right. And then usually further on down the line, later on in the ritual, where you've, you know, bound the spirit, or you have actively met, like sought out an agreement with it of some kind of capacity, there will usually be some kind of confirmation. And that's like a confirmational sign. The two biggest ones I've had with that are weather anomalies. So I've had one of my weirdest ones I had was when I was doing a ceremonial ritual, not with the Guaisha, but with another sort of Kia Solomon grimoire. And it was a clear kind of, it was a clear day. Like it was sunny-ish, you know, it was like clear sky. And when I sort of finished the ritual and it was kind of done and dusted, and then I had interacted with the spirit as far as I could tell, and we had sort of come to an agreement on something, it just started raining outside. And it was a clear sky completely. There was like not a cloud in the sky, it's blue sky. And it just randomly started raining for like 2 minutes after I sort of said, okay, do you accept? I got to the kind of the binding part. Like, okay, do you accept? Give me a sign that you accept kind of the agreement we've made. And then it started raining. And then as soon as I sort of took that to be like, okay, that's interesting. And then as soon as I kind of, I'm hesitant to say sort of signed the deal, but that kind of effectiveness, like committed the binding to paper effectively in my books, the rain stopped. Yeah. And it was like that kind of thing is weird and interesting to me, where it's like you have a completely clear day and it just starts raining out of nowhere, and it's like then it just suddenly stops. It's a weird thing. Or the other side of it is, you like sometimes, I think when I spoke to Stephen about this, he said that he had some kind of, usually like there'll be like some object will fall off a shelf or something, or like something will like fall over or something, that like the spirit is like, and that's a sign the spirit's told you it's accepted or whatever. But I don't know. It's an interesting thing. But the PGM is different because it's an ancient magic, right? And all the Greek magical papyri, so it's an ancient magic. And we're really dealing with a different worldview here. And we can kind of also, to a certain extent, loop in, you know, Druidry here as well, because like I think it's probably the same, not the same, but that they would have had a similar kind of philosophy on how their gods spoke to them. Or what that looked like, you know, what that experience looked like. And it's really this thing of theophanies. So theophany is a Greek word. It literally means the appearance of a god, right? So Theophanes, or Phanine. And it's a sign well, like literally it means sign from the gods, right? So there will be correspondences or, you know, animals or whatever that are associated with the god or the spirit you're working with or something like that. And when you see those things, it's a sign the gods are interacting with you or speaking to you, right? And this is one of the things that I think we have also lost track with in modern ritual practice, where we are really divorcing ourselves from nature a lot of the time.
Agreed.
And we really, if you're getting into magical practice, especially something like, you know, druidry or any kind of nature-based faith, but it also stands true for ancient religions as well, they saw the natural world as inhabited by tons of spirits. And mm-hmm. natural world in general is, think of it like, you know, I've often described it in my theology as the natural world is the body of God, effectively. You know, if there's the divine intellect, which is the animating force, you know, that kind of like that serpent's breath in the landscape, that enlivening force, nature itself is the body of God, you know, whatever capacity you think that, or however you describe God. But that means it's also, nature is also a tool for communication, effectively, right? And when you look in deeper into nature, you will see signs and attributes and then theophanies, so appearances from gods.
Yeah, right? Which is the importance of, see, this is why I have the, I hold divination is so important. Mm. Just quickly, because I think we get 60 minutes of recording time.
So we might be
recording
okay.
time. So yeah. We might be able to carry on. If it lets us carry on, I'll edit this bit out. But mm-hmm. if we wait until it hits 60 minutes, if it cuts us out, what I'll yep. do is I'll send you another message.
Yep.
And we'll start and we'll just, are we all right to just wrap it up? And then
yep.
We'll find out where we can find you online, so on and so forth. Yep. But we'll see what happens when it reaches 60 minutes. This is all yep. fab. This is all brilliant. It's great fun. I can't believe anyway, I'm not going to say that because I'm going to wait until it hits 60 minutes and see what it says. Thank you, by the way, for joining us today and being so patient and coming online with us. It's been
it's been great. Yeah,
really, really good. I want to find out what this community thing is. Are you online with it?
Yeah. So yeah. It's effectively like, think of it like a private social media platform.
Oh, cool. Okay.
For occultism. But the difference with it is like all of us, like I came together with myself and a couple of other friends who are either coaches or other occultists and spiritual people. Yeah. And our sort of core value with it, like the core thing with it was like, we just kind of got sick of having to have like all your texts in one place and then having like, you know, going into like a Facebook group or like going over to YouTube to find stuff. It's like, okay, I want to put everything all in one place, but like you can have your yeah. courses, everything. Oh, see if we get cut off. Hold on.
So you were mentioning, you just said about the natural world being the body yeah. of God. Being the body of God. Oh, shut up. Being. I think that's really important, especially within the context of Druidry. And I find that not enough people are probably going to shout at me for this. Oh, I don't care. Shove off. But don't think enough people within the Druid space look, when they do ritual, when they perform magic, when they then practice their art, then watch, listen, and wait for something to tell them it worked. I don't yeah. think there's enough. And I may be tarring a lot of people with the same brush. And that's not fair. And I don't care. I've done something unfair before. Doesn't matter. but I think this mentality that the natural world is then divorced from you and you're divorced from it is just completely stupid.
Yeah.
You know, I think people rationalize too much. So you'd yeah. sit there and you'd go, right, I've asked for a spirit to do a thing. And then something falls off of the shelf on the wall because a bus has gone by at the same time
yeah.
and you go, oh well, it's because the bus drove by. And it's like, yes, but that bus drives by 30 to 50 times a day. You've yeah. lived there for 3 years and it's never came off. Yeah. It's never fallen off that shelf before, but today the spirit decided that it was going to use the momentum that exists in the natural world to make something happen. Stop over rationalizing. And I know I've probably done the reverse rationalizing thing, but I think people will kind of go, well, that happened because of this. And it's like, yeah, but it was an answer. Just because it happened in the natural world doesn't make it less magical, less spiritual, or less part of the process. All of this exists within the universe. The whole magic, the whole spirit thing, all of it exists within this frame of reference. So don't then discredit the frame of reference just because it corresponds to something else that happened at the same time. Maybe the spirit needed that thing to help it do the job you were asking it to do.
I agree.
The physical world is a manifestation of the spiritual world, as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Yeah, well, I have to do it all the time. Whenever I pray or ask for anything, or I'm asking or looking, you know, for answers to questions, I can't expect to hear God's voice in my ear go, yes, Lyndon.
No.
Exactly. Like, you know, or have Mary appear and kind of chat to me over tea. It's not going to happen. So I have to, if I do ask for anything or pray for anything, I have to then spend my day with my ears and eyes open and aware of interactions I may have or conversations I may have or something that happened that'll yield an answer to the question I've asked.
Yeah.
Because I always have to keep in mind that God works on a greater scope. So there'll be things in play that will give me my answers. I just can't guarantee that it will happen in the way that I expect.
And the natural world is a canvas for things to be created and written out and all the rest of it. Chris, this has been absolutely amazing and absolutely brilliant. You mentioned an online thing and a podcast. Can you tell people who have not heard of you where they can find you?
So my personal website and also the YouTube channel where I'm doing my podcasts is Mystai, so mystai.co.uk, which is also the ancient Greek word for initiate, which is where I think I got it from, like initiate of the mysteries. So that's my main personal one, and my blogs and my writing and all that kind of thing are up on there, as well as my courses and things. I'm currently also teaching a course on magic in general, but with a focus on the PGM and ceremonial magic. But we also launched, like me and a couple of friends got together, really sort of last month, we launched last month more or less, to build a new, like effectively an occult spiritual education platform, effectively, where our core value with it really is a sense of unity, right? A sense of unity and connectedness, where we got tired of having to go to so many different places to get our information and put everything together. It all just felt a bit disjointed. So we ended up, okay, let's go and get, or let's build out a new platform where you can have, you know, you can get courses and have like private social media feeds and all sorts of things, people like typical Instagram, Facebook thing for occultism, but for occultism, but also you have courses in there and scans of manuscripts and libraries and all that kind of thing up there, all of which, and also, you know, weekly, daily meditation, weekly events, all that kind of thing, all in one place, so that you don't have to go to so many different places and so jump through so many different hoops to get your practice going. You can kind of, you know, go through, look at it and be like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm taking this course and it's on astrological magic or ceremonial stuff or druid, whatever it is. I want to look at some books on Druidry to support my reading. Okay, well, you have an entire library at your disposal, like within the app as well. And like, because it's an app and you can access it on desktop as well.
That's cool.
If you want to look at that, it's goldenshadowacademy.com. And the golden shadow is from Jung originally. And it's kind of the untapped creative potential of an individual, right? It's the healthy version of the shadow, effectively.
Awesome.
I'm not sure the idea from, but yeah, that's kind of where I hang out most of these days on my own little private social media.
The magic. How the other half live. That's cool. That's so cool. Well, thank you so much for being our guest today on the podcast and bringing your ramblings to our ramblings and whatnot.
Yes.
I think that's it for today. And so this is Shoved Up Your Arwen. You can find us on Instagram at Shoved Up Your Arwen. All good.
And all other places.
And all other places. There's loads of other places. We've got a website. We're online. Just type Shove It Up Your Arwen on Google and we'll turn up. You'll find stuff. It's all good. So thanks very much and bye.
Bye.
Bye.